So welcome. On behalf of the Peace, Environment, and Christian Social Concerns Committee of the Berkeley Friends Church. So I'm sure you all know that we're here to do a brief presentation on the climate of hope, how cities, businesses, and citizens can save the planet. So before we begin, why don't we take just a moment of silence, as Quakers are wont to do. The basic premise of this book is that spreading fear about the dire repercussions of climate change doesn't work. And that what we need to do is let people know about what's happening around the globe in various aspects, in agriculture, in water, in energy, in transportation, in many areas. Things are happening in cities, in countries, around the world, that hopefully will give us a sense of hope that things are happening and also ways in which we might become involved. So let's see the polar bear slide there. So we had the polar bear because that's sort of how it all started with our committee. Dharma Galang, who is our former clerk of the Peace, Environment, and Christian Social Concerns Committee, thought it would be really nice if we could do something about our carbon footprint and kind of associate it with International Polar Bear Day, which I guess is in 2 days. So as we all know, polar bears are struggling with climate change, so we want to help them out. So we'd like to, we're going to focus on three sources of information, water and energy and agriculture, and a little bit on forestation, deforestation and reforestation. So I'd like you to hold your questions until the end, if you would, please. And I think some people have cards. Does anybody else need a card in case they want to write down a question? And Hanako has more. Okay. All right, then. We're going to start with water. And just to let you know, I am not an expert on this subject. I only read the book and wrote down what I thought was really interesting. And then I consulted my husband, Fred Neal. Why don't you stand up, Fred? Stand up. Who has 45 years... of experience in water and water treatment. So he's our resident expert in water. And fortunately, we also have an expert in energy. Mary is an energy analyst, so she's going to do the energy portion. And also, Tom Nocera is here. He's our cousin, and has graduated from UC Davis in agriculture. And so he's going to help us with questions on agriculture. Okay, but first of all, we're going to start with water. So let's see, we got the water slide. We kind of maybe simplistically put things in two categories, bad news, good news. But we wanted to make sure that people knew that there were solutions, maybe not comprehensive solutions, but some solutions. So sudden and severe rainstorms, of course, is one of the aspects of climate change, as we've all observed the last year. And so what can we do about it? One of the things we can do is to create sponge zones or create permeable surfaces for the water to go through to the groundwater instead of just sliding off the impermeable hardscape. So we have a picture of, I'm going to go up, yeah, there we go. Here's a bioengineered media going into the groundwater to support the groundwater table. So that's a real help instead of having it go just on the concrete or on the paving. China also faced severe historic floods in 2016, and according to the book, they created permeable concrete so that you could pour a whole truckload of water on this concrete and it would immediately disappear. So that kind of thing is really helpful to help absorb excess water. Of course, creating parks. Go back to the other slide. Parks, it's just a no-brainer, right? And then what are bioswales? Bioswales are thousands of cities are doing this, where they're installing sidewalk extensions to channel the water into the soil instead of it going down the drain. The other thing, I forgot water squares. Let's go to the water square slide. I thought this was really interesting. I don't know if this is a picture of Rotterdam, but in Rotterdam, it's very low. And they create these below-grade, sunken public places where people can enjoy recreation of all kinds when it's not raining. But then when it is raining, it can collect water and collect up to 450,000 gallons of water. So this is another great idea for collecting water. The other thing, a lot of water is wasted. So one thing that we can do is to recharge our many aquifers that have been depleted. Let's show the aquifer slide that shows how depleted the aquifers are in our country. There we go. So you can see how the different aquifers, and those that are red or orange are the most depleted. So we really need to recharge those aquifers. And according to the book, California has 5 times the storage capacity in aquifers below the ground than it does above the ground. Creating more dams and that kind of thing is not really viable, but it is better and perhaps more feasible to recharge those aquifers, which we have a big one you can see in California. The other thing we can do is to recycle water and wastewater. And Fred knows a lot about that because he was in charge of doing that in Marin County. And San Francisco is doing that. And I hope many more people are trying to reuse their water. The treated water that could go on parks and golf courses, and in some cases in agriculture, to be reused instead of just going down the drain into the bay. The other thing that we need to do is to change our agricultural laws, especially in this state, to encourage rather than discourage farmers to recapture and reuse their water. Okay, this is the water portion of the talk.
We have one more slide here.
Oh, just okay. This is, yeah, good, thank you. Mm-hmm. This is the aquifer storage and recovery. So you can see an injection well can put water into the aquifer, and then the storm water and wastewater, treated, of course, can go into, also go into recharge the aquifer. So an important thing that can be done. And is being done to a certain extent, although Fred says it's not enough is being done. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So 10 minutes to share with you everything I know about energy, right? No. As Mom indicated, I'm just going to hit some highlights today. And you know, we also encourage you all to, of course, read the book Climate of Hope. There's a lot more information in there. But to continue the theme of bad news and good news about climate change and energy, One piece of bad news is that cities are a huge source of greenhouse gas emissions. 70%, according to the book. I mean, that's largely for buildings, especially heating and cooling buildings, also constructing, and other things. So what are we going to do about cities? Well, there's actually lots and lots of things going on. We have so many advancements in green building design. The book champions white roofs, which are, you know, it's a simple way, it's an inexpensive way to change the color of your roof, and then that the white will reflect more light and reduce cooling costs. And of course, efficient lighting, which has been widespread in California now for a long time, moving away from incandescent bulbs, has saved a tremendous amount of energy. And there's, I mean, we could do a whole presentation hour long on green building design in terms of green roofs, solar panels on rooftops, use of natural light in architecture, so much more. Advanced control systems, I mean, it goes on and on and on. So the good news is that as we continue to build our cities, we're getting smarter about our buildings, and these are, you know, becoming part of our building standards and codes. And city leadership is really stepping up to combat climate change. A lot of mayors have signed a pledge to do more, and there's a lot of city plans and action plans. So that's good. And on a macro level, the growth in electric demand has really stalled in the U.S. If I see any projections greater than 1% per year, I generally don't believe them. It's usually 1% or less. In some areas, it's declining. And that we have a lot, we can thank all these people who work so hard on energy efficiency in part to thank for that. So that's very good news. Okay, some more bad news. As we all know, fossil fuel combustion is what causes greenhouse gas pollutions. It pollutes the air we breathe. And of all the fossil fuels, coal really is the most destructive. It emits one quarter of all greenhouse gas emissions. It kills also through respiratory disease from particulates and toxic mercury. It's also another killer. It destroys rivers and groundwater and causes acid rain. So it's toxic stuff, and we really need to get away from it. And the good news is that we are. The use of coal in this country has peaked. It's now declining and declining fast, and if anything, that decline is accelerating. It's really not economically viable to build new coal plants anymore. Natural gas and low prices are a big part of that, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But also renewables have become just much more economic. And the book also discusses the Beyond Coal campaign from Sierra Club. That has helped close or phase out 240 plants. But really, more closures are being announced like all the time. It's just like an everyday occurrence in the energy world is to hear about another coal plant shutting down because it's just not economic to run. So on this next slide, I have a graphic that sort of shows, if I can bring up a laser pointer. So starting off here on the left side is coal consumption. So this line is a little bit pale, but it's risen, you know, since 1950, it's risen. But basically, in the mid-2000s, it peaked. And so now it's steeply declined, and it continues to fall. And the big reason for that, of course, is natural gas. So this shows natural gas production increasing. And a large part that's due to shale gas and fracking, which I'll talk about in a second. This increased production has lowered prices, and that's really caused coal to be completely uneconomic. It all kind of summarized, I think, quite well in this last graph, where this gray line in the middle is the cost of coal. So over time, since 2009, it really hasn't moved much, right? It's about the same as it was. But you can see in that time, the blue line, which is gas, has been much cheaper, and it's falling. And wind is the same. And also, there's another their pink line that starts up here. This is solar. So, you know, back in 2009, when I was basically getting out of grad school, solar was still kind of uncompetitive. But now it's right down here. In the past 2 years, everyone's talking about solar. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as well. So let's talk a little bit about more about natural gas and fracking, because I'm sure some of you are thinking, isn't fracking a bad thing? you've seen the Gasland movie, right? So there's good news and bad news, really. The bad news is that, yes, the extraction of gas and the fracking, it leaks methane into the atmosphere. Methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, much more so than CO2. And also, it can pollute the fracking, it can pollute groundwater supplies, which is a major concern. But the good news, as I've already talked about, is this gas has decimated the coal industry. So we're moving away from coal, which I still believe is way more toxic and worse. But I think it is important that we regulate fracking. If we can regulate it successfully, plug the leaks, prevent methane from escaping, and make sure that, you know, we don't frack in areas that will, put critical groundwater supplies at risk, then I think we can do it right. And if it's too expensive to do it right, then let's not do it. So that's basically my position and also the position of the authors in the book. So that's what basically a brief introduction on that topic. And now we'll talk a little bit more about solar. So bad news, solar is expensive. But as I showed in that graph, the good news is that it's actually not so expensive anymore. The technology has advanced. Manufacturing methods have advanced. And so the cost of the panels has dropped dramatically, continues to fall. It's now just a major player. And California is a leader, of course, but it's all over the country. There's more and more interest in building solar. And it's a similar story with battery storage. So battery storage, the cost of that has also declined. And the biggest technology out there is actually lithium ion. It's the same batteries that power all of our electronic devices, portable electronic devices. And because of that, you know, that demand for portable electronic devices has actually driven a lot of the technology and the advancement and driven down the costs. And if we can pair that solar PV with battery storage, we can power the whole planet because solar is such an abundant resource. So that's the good news. I'm actually more optimistic now than I think I've ever been that we can really have 100% renewable energy in our grid. It's coming. One other issue with solar is it is a large upfront cost. It's a capital investment. It does pay off over time, but that can be a barrier if someone struggling to pay their bills, but they could benefit from solar. What do they do? Well, there is increasingly more financing available. So there's a lot of programs in California and other places. So it can happen, and we're doing it. So to close out, I just wanted to share a couple graphs showing the wind resource and solar resource across the United States. This just gives you a sense of, you know, how wind power potential is distributed. So the purple and the red here, especially in the center of the country, that's the best wind resource. The green areas are not so good. So there's sort of a question now as to whether, you know, are we going to build huge wind farms over here in the heartland and then also build large transmission lines to bring that power to load centers, especially on the East Coast, or not? Right, because there's not a whole lot of people that actually live here. There's not a whole lot of demand. I think the author of the book is largely supportive of this idea, but I would sort of caution. I sort of put up a note of caution because I do think that building large transmission facilities is pretty expensive. I think it's more expensive than the authors discuss in the book. A large transmission project for high voltage DC up in Manitoba went way over budget. So we just have to be mindful of that. And we do have other solutions because solar, you know, you can do solar just about anywhere. The solar map here shows that it's definitely, you know, better here in the Southwest. You get more solar, more sun means, you know, your capital investment will go farther. But you can do it pretty much anywhere. So I think, you know, at that sort of means we probably don't need as much transmission. But there will be more transmission lines for wind, for sure. I mean, that is also a trend. So anyway, that's all I had on energy. for now until there are questions. So I'll leave it back to Mom.
I have to have little 3x5 cards. Anyway, so eating and farming. Okay, we're at there. So fertilizer overuse is number one there. I don't know that they're really in a big order, but just things that we came up with that the book showed were sources of bad news and what the good news was to counteract some of the bad news. So the overuse of nitrogen fertilizer is the primary source and the third most damaging greenhouse gas, nitrous oxide. And concentrations have increased almost 20% since the Industrial Revolution over the last 120 years. So they know how to measure this precisely now, which is pretty interesting. So the good news that there is new precision technologies so that farmers can decide by soil mapping just exactly what the soil needs rather than just pouring a bunch of nitrogen on top of the soil. Their precision technologies can help them have better yields and it costs less. In Ethiopia, I thought this was a pretty wonderful story. They did this soil mapping and used this precision technology, and their wheat yield increased 40%. And so it cost less, took less water, had bigger profits. So that's a huge win. Another problem is carbon stripping by deep plowing. That's sort of the traditional method of how we've done farming. But new farming technologies have come up, which have helped to keep the carbon in the soil rather than having it being emitted by too much plowing or overgrazing. So there is a slide that shows that. There it is. Okay. So on the left, you see the conventional kind of farming, where the soil does not retain the carbon dioxide. Instead, it goes off into the atmosphere. The new farming technologies, no-till or low-till, the soil becomes a carbon sink and retains the carbon instead of emitted into the atmosphere. So tests have shown that soil have become carbon were carbon emitters due to this technology have turned into carbon sinks. And once again, cost less, use less water, and produce higher profits. Okay, back to slide number one. Okay, meat-heavy diets, I think is kind of no-brainer for most of us, right? But just to let everybody know, it's a meat-heavy diet is 2 times the carbon impact of a vegetarian diet. So, plus, cows produce methane quite a lot because there's so many of them. 1.5 billion cows equal 2 billion tons of greenhouse gas. So, plus, cows drink a lot. So, the more meat we eat, the more rely on that kind of diet, the more water is also consumed. A lot of food is wasted. Food waste. And it's a big problem because we waste a third to a half of the fruits and vegetables produced in this country. And the pantry can tell you about that because the pantry is able to, what do you call it?
Grocery rescue.
Thank you. Grocery stores give to the pantry hundreds of pounds of fruits and vegetables that they would otherwise throw away. So a lot of waste in our society. It's really important that we separate organic waste from other kinds of waste, because just throwing fruits and vegetables, organic waste, into a landfill produces methane. So we don't want to do that. The book says we could reduce spoilage with plastic crates. I don't know. Think about that. We could modify quality standards so we don't expect the picture-perfect fruit and vegetable. And we can standardize expiration dates and not rely on the food industry to create them. One of the problems in developing world is cooking with biomass. Wood, and straw, cow dung over an open fire. These open pit fires produce 25% of the world's black carbon. And the World Health Association says it's the fourth largest risk factor for disease in the developing world, and kills 4 million people, mostly women and children, every year. So there's a need to access clean energy, natural gas, propane, ethanol. And the book says that not enough is being done here, that we need government subsidies to help with that. Poor nations are most at risk from climate change. They're ground zero due to drought, heat, and lack of water. And Nigeria, Kenya, and Uganda are ranked 147, 154, and 160 of the 180 nations that are ranked. The low ranking means that they have the higher risk due to climate change. Now, the European Union has provided seed capital, so that's the good news, in African Risk Capacity is the name of the organization that has provided seed capital. But there's still a shortfall of $488 billion. So there's a lot needed, more needed there to help these poor countries. So what is global Embrapa? That's at the bottom there are the good news. and probably Tommy knows about this. But I thought this was really exciting news and really a source of hope. That the new agricultural revolution in Brazil is open-sourced, publicly funded, and accessible. And in 10 years after the launch of this program, the agricultural production rose by 365% without genetically engineered private patents and without destroying rainforest for new crops. So that is so huge. So they say Embrapa, I think, is the word that Brazil uses, and maybe somebody can explain what that is. But anyway, so the book says this should be a global phenomena, and that agriculture would really be helped by the policies that Brazil has accepted. Okay, next slide, please. I didn't have anything about the timber.
That's coming up.
Oh.
This is just showing the fertilizer.
Oh, okay. Issue. Thank you, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this shows you the fertilizer. I forgot about this. The green actually is overuse of nitrogen fertilizers. So feast or famine, it says. And let's see. deficiency. There are some areas of deficiency, but as you can see, where the largest green areas are where there's overuse of the nitrogen fertilizers.
China's the biggest offender, and it knows it, but...
Okay. Okay, so timber rack?
Forests.
Timber, okay, forests. Okay, so this was something that I had no idea when I first read the book, and it was very interesting, that globally there's a timber racket. Maybe some of you know about this already, but most of the timber that's acquired is illegally logged. And not only that, not only is it illegally logged and illegally acquired, but it's harvested by slave labor. In Indonesia, 70% of the lumber is illegally logged. So there's been some efforts to crack down on this, to sort out, but not enough. And so in the book, this story of Carl Pope trying to redo his redwood deck. And he knew that he couldn't find redwood anywhere. And so how to find timber that wasn't illegally logged. So there is an organization called the Forest Stewardship Certification Council that you can look at, and they will help you find timber that isn't illegally logged. So I think all of us thinking of some kind of project should look into that. Okay, mangrove picture. Okay, this is another really exciting thing, I thought, that the book said that simply by restoring a half of the mangroves lost since 1980, we could store up to 6 billion tons of CO2, which is equal to U.S. emissions each year. So let's plant some mangroves. So, and also deforestation is a problem, of course, but countries have signed on to do better with that. And India has, in its Paris Pledge, committed to increase its forest cover from 21% to 33%. And in one day, they planted 50 million trees. So, I mean, that's a really great story. And we could all be planting more trees. The book says that agriculture and reforestation are the best hope for reducing the effects of climate change. So we can now take questions, which hopefully Mary will answer.
No. Well, we do have one more slide up here. This shows, this is sort of like an artist's depiction of a forest city where they basically have green all over every building on every surface. So these are some of the ideas that people have as ways to incorporate more plants, basically, into our lives, our urban lives.
Can you explain why plants are important in terms of the technology? What does a plant do? Why is it so important to the global warming?
So plants photosynthesize, right? So they actually take up CO2 when they do that. So that's why when we also deforest, not only are we cutting out, you know, plants that are photosynthesizing and taking up carbon, but we're also potentially, you know, burning and wasting all the wood that is carbon, right, and sending that into the atmosphere. So that's the problem.
So it's a double whammy.
Right.
Plus, we want the soil to absorb the carbon rather than the seas. It's really a problem that...
Yes.
The seas are being destroyed. Some of the coral reefs and stuff are being destroyed by too much carbon. So we want the soil to absorb the excess carbon. Right, Tommy?
Yeah, like organisms are acting. They don't photosynthesize, like the microorganisms in the soil, but they basically do the same thing. They function the same way as a tree would, but just a really small level. And if we don't till, or if we do other things to protect their lives, we can protect the soil and grow it and reduce our carbon dioxide emissions and like reverse that.
Great.
Question?
I'm what is the difference in the footprint from a vegan diet versus a vegetarian diet?
I don't know.
Do you know?
We did look at a slide for protein. They do caution that cheese and dairy, you know, are kind of a high source of CO2 because you have all those cows that are producing the cheese and the dairy. So probably vegan, I'm sure is much less, but I don't know. I don't know the difference.
Was that on the World Resources Institute?
It depends. Like, where you got your vegan foods, where you got your vegetarian foods. Like, if transportation is a really large cost of, a large environmental cost of most of your food, so if you had a smaller local footprint, then that would be better. But at the same time, if you're eating, like, I don't know, I'm struggling to come up with an example, but something that was a vegetarian item that was like really high emissions versus a vegan item that was far away but really low emissions.
Oh, so
really, it could balance out. But it's hard to say.
So buy and eat locally produced food.
That's what I would say.
The best thing you can do for the environment.
Easy here in California.
Tell me.
There's a major difference between vegan and vegetarian. Vegetarian does involve cows. Cows are some of the worst, as you said, the worst methane it is. So they're not comparable. They're very different. A vegan diet, yes, there's some transportation costs, but if you have a vegan diet with a relatively local focus, it's way better than vegetarian.
Russ raised hand first.
No-till farming, is that done manually, or do they use equipment in the no-till?
Go, Tom.
They're just instead of tilling, there's no tilling, and that's basically the main difference. And in order to get rid of weeds, they typically use more pesticides.
So that's the bad part of it.
The downside. But pesticides don't really contribute to carbon dioxide, if you think about it. You know, so you gotta figure out where your priorities lie. They still do, you know, a little bit of tillage to pick up the plant when they're done with the season. But other than that, that's about it.
Okay. Great.
Tilling had a purpose.
Yes.
And so how is the same purpose achieved?
By
not tilling.
Just by killing it with pesticides. That's basically the most effective way.
So 10-15 years ago, I was doing a project at the University of California for SED, building a new campus. One of the things they said they were going to be using by now, 15 years, because it was going to be cost effective, was fuel cells. And you never mentioned fuel cells in your talk, and I'm curious to what happened to fuel cells. You know, where did that technology disappear?
So, well, it hasn't totally disappeared, especially for transportation. I think Toyota. Yeah, fuel cells. Fuel cells is basically much like a battery. But instead of it being all self-contained and all the energy stored within the cell, you have fuel continuously fed into the fuel cell, and then it can produce energy through very advanced chemistry that I won't get into. Still CO2, you know. Yeah, well, just like with combustion, you get CO2 and water. But, mm-hmm. CO2 is the big concern, though. And a lot of fuel cells really just run on natural gas. So it's just another way to, you know, basically convert energy from natural gas to something else, like basically to electricity. So why not use fuel cells? The biggest selling point on fuel cells was basically that they're very efficient. They're more efficient than some of the other technologies that we do use all over the place for burning gas, especially gas turbines in combined cycle plants. which is just a combined cycle plant is just a plant where you actually combine a steam turbine and a gas turbine, and it just makes it more efficient. So what we've found is that as the technologies have developed, the fuel cells just haven't, we haven't seen the same cost decreases that we did for our other technologies. So they still remain relatively expensive, and the efficiency gains just aren't that much compared to, well, it's, there's still an efficiency gain, but it's just not as much value, not enough value, especially with low-cost natural gas, to make it more economic on the whole to do a fuel cell as opposed to other types of plants. So we haven't really seen fuel cells much in power generation. There's still some talk of doing hydrogen fuel cells where hydrogen is the fuel, but often hydrogen is just reformed from natural gas for cars. I still don't think that's really realistic compared to batteries. I think batteries are simpler and easier and just are going to win that one, but we'll see. Thank you first.
Actually, I've been seeing a lot of hydrogen fuel cells going up and down the mm-hmm. street in the AC transit buses. So which brings to my question is you haven't really talked much about transportation, considering, well, when Berkeley did its pilot plan, it discovered that about one-third of its CO2 emissions are coming from personal transportation. I didn't read the book, so did they talk about the...
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, they do.
We only centered on these three topics, but yes, oh, definitely talks about transportation and what can be done there.
That's partly just me because I have more expertise in power grid related items as opposed to transportation. But they're now becoming increasingly linked with the rise of electric vehicles. And if we have obviously a transition to renewables in the power grid and we have electric cars, we can power vehicles with renewable energy. So that's very exciting to me. And that's, people are talking a lot about that in the energy world and utility industry. So, but yes, there are the hydrogen fuel cells, especially for buses, I will say it's a lot easier because it's a larger vehicle, so there's more storage space, essentially, to store the hydrogen. So that's a good application.
Yep. Michael Bloomberg talks about in New York closing off to traffic Times Square. And when that first came up, he thought it was completely crazy. But it's something that can be done to reduce traffic and reduce cars. Just one of the ideas that's in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, there's public transit too, obviously. That's taking public transit is a huge thing we can all do for the environment.
Before I ask my question, I'm going to say that New York City has a really terrible problem with their subways. They're old and they're falling apart, and people can't use them anymore as much as they did. So that's a bad news. Anyhow, my question was, I don't completely understand. Well, I guess let me start again. Trump has put an import tax on solar panels. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, most of the people who manufacture solar panels in the United States have quit because they weren't making money. So that means we don't have solar panels to use. Or won't have enough.
Well, let me respond to that. I actually anticipated that question. So the question is actually about solar panels and tariffs on solar panels, imported solar panels. So a lot of the decrease in costs we're seeing for solar PV has actually come from China, really, and their innovations in bringing down the cost of the manufacturing. So they're now by far the largest manufacturers of PV panels in the world. And they achieved that largely through subsidies. So tariffs actually started under the Obama administration because there was just concern that with, you know, China being able to just dump subsidized panels into the U.S. market, that could just put all of our, U.S. manufacturing out of business. But the tariffs really haven't worked. in many ways, I mean, China's still the dominant player. They're still manufacturing the majority of panels and increasing. And in response to the tariffs, what China did was actually start investing more domestically, as well as exporting to other markets, especially India. So India is now their largest export market for solar. Which is also good news, though. I mean, all these countries all around the world are adopting this technology. It's not just here in the U.S. or just in Europe. The book says the tariffs are kind of a bad idea. I agree that the tariffs are a bad idea. But I don't think it's going to stop the transition to solar. And even the thing that it can do, of course, is drive up the costs. But even that, I mean, people, since they've anticipated the tariffs, they've done some hoarding of the panels already, so they they have some stored up and ready to go already, so that'll help reduce some of the cost increases.
I think Michael was...
Sure.
I just wanted to add a little bit to that. The WTO is an organization that governs the rules for trade agreements and determines kind of what is an acceptable retaliation. So the concern from other nations other than China is that China is doing more than just subsidizing domestic industries. So it's seen as acceptable to subsidize the domestic industry, to have it grow, to say, oh, we're going to get here to produce the solar panels, we're going to sell them to ourselves. What is not seen as acceptable internationally is subsidizing the industry to the point where you're then going to throw that onto world markets. That's seen as non-competitive, which was, I think, the original basis for the tariffs under the Obama administration. But again, the amount of these subsidies is much less than it used to. So China is not subsidizing these industries as much as it has been. And also, as stated with the trade with India, there's a lot of leakage that not all countries are retaliating, so they just sell to somewhere else. So the tariffs themselves, questionable how much impact they're going to have without any sort of international reporting or response. And we're kind of just shooting ourselves in the foot right now without any cooperation.
Yeah, I mean, there is a little bit of evidence that some factories are opening here in the U.S. because of the tariffs, you know, and the protectionist trade. But also, the caveat there, too, is that a lot of those factories will be owned by Chinese companies.
Okay. Can you say something about the talk that you're talking about? What Trump has done and what the energy solar panels. What about coal? Building back the coal industry, bringing it back. And it sounds pretty futile to pretend to do that, but there is this movement, and so how is that kind of balance?
Yeah. So, I mean, I could probably talk on that subject for a really long time. So, so let me try and. Give a short version. So basically, there's been a lot of lies by Republican Party, especially about coal and in the U.S. coal industry, saying that, you know, it's all like the Obama administration and they're out to get them and put them all out of business and it's their policies. And that's just not true. It's really other things. It's the natural gas prices is the biggest thing. Also, for the eastern coal fields, they're more expensive. It's more expensive to mine there than it is in the western states. So, so the eastern mines are actually just being put out of business by the western mines. If you follow any of the politics there in that specific region. So basically, this idea that we'll just get rid of some regulations and then it'll all, you know, coal will come back. No. it won't. The only thing that could keep coal going is massive subsidies. So we are seeing some movement from the Trump administration towards subsidizing coal. That's something we want to oppose. It will be opposed by lots of organizations. Best we can do is really just stay abreast of that and oppose it as best we can and write letters to Congress, keep them on their toes. But also, the organizations like Sierra Club, they will sue to stop it. So, and we can support them as well.
I want to thank you for teaching me a new word today, RAPA. But I'm still confused. What exactly does the word mean? And did Brazil subsidize this program, or was it private partnership?
Tom, do you know more about this?
You know, I don't.
I could take some time to look it up in the book, exactly what it is. It's just a policies by Brazil to, you know, in our country you have all these patents for genetically modified foods, and it's, you know, kind of keeps things tight rather than opens up the market. So they're trying to make everything much more accessible. But yeah, how it actually works, I probably would have a whole thesis in itself. But I can take a look at the book while we answer more questions. Just a minute.
Latin America generally does not like ownership of patents. It does not like ownership of crops. They have a huge, they do not favor that at all.
Right.
So there's a big social movement there. And there's just a strong farmers' movement, farmers' rights movement there. So I'm not surprised that they have brought up support that. I don't know what else they did to succeed in growing and developing their crops.
How unfair to Monsanto.
Could we make that the rallying cry word to counter Kobe?
Brapa is a rallying cry against Kofi. Do you know the word Kofi? No. We'll talk to Mom later. Get her up to speed. Oh, Michael?
Yeah. What sorts of racking regulations do the authors recommend?
I think it's largely probably along the lines of the regulations that the Obama administration tried to implement in terms of making sure that the biggest thing I think is making sure that their wells don't leak gas out. You know, that they have like if you have any like little crack right in the well that they drill, then it can leak out. So it's important to have those plugged. I could do a whole sort of talk about fracking, but it would get pretty technical and probably bore you all to tears. So, but anyway, but there are definitely ideas out there. There are, the Obama administration attempted to regulate it. That got tied up in the courts. Trump wants to roll that back. So there's definitely more that we could do to support regulation of fracking and make sure that it's done right. But again, the other thing we can also do is just go to renewables. So they're really the frontier.
Real quickly, sure. I don't have a question, but Embrapa has a great Wikipedia entry. That will just sum up. Their mission is to, quote, develop research, development, and innovation solutions for the sustainability of agriculture for the benefit of Brazilian society. And Embrapa is an abbreviation of Empresa Brasileira de Pesquisa Agropecuária, which means Brazilian Agricultural Research Corporation.
Thank you.
And stay home.
Yeah.
Ken?
Well, just kind of working out with Michael's observations, as far as regulation goes and subsidies, did the book say anything about how the true cost of big oil, you know, if we subsidized solar, for example, to match what we're really subsidizing big oil for, solar really wouldn't be that expensive at all. Is there any?
It is a complicated patchwork, really. You know, basically all forms of energy are subsidized. You know, solar has subsidies. Oil has massive numbers of subsidies, and people, you know, consider all the wars in the Middle East as just one big subsidy for oil. So, so it is hard to do a fair comparison of different technologies. And also, you also have to incorporate the cost of the expected cost of climate change too. And you're thinking about: do we really want to build this gas plant? Should we build wind? And that's actually what I do for a living: is to actually try my best to take a hard look at all those factors and try and help decision makers make the right choice.
Just a postscript, a local postscript on the last gas. What we hope is the last gas. Coal
that Utah oil fields are trying to export their coal because they can't use it in the U.S. And there's a case that's currently in federal court in San Francisco because the city of Oakland made it illegal to store coal in Oakland. And Phil Tagami, who's a developer in Oakland, leased land at the foot of the Bay Bridge and decided he wanted to put a giant coal terminal there so they could by rail transport coal out mostly to Asia, I think. And so he sued the city of Oakland in order to have this giant, it's called Oakland Bulk Oversized Terminal, just OBOT for the acronym. He sued the city of Oakland, and so City of Oakland with the support of Sierra Club and San Francisco Baykeepers, who were, they were represented by Earth Justice, just completed the suit in this month, actually, in San Francisco. The judge has yet to, it's Vince Chalky, I think, has yet to, he's taken all the information in, has yet to rule on it. There are already coal cars that come down this rail line if you go west toward the highway. But if he ruled in favor of OBOT, there would be a lot more. And I've been told that that coal manufacturers assume that 20% of the volume of the coal will disappear from the car in transport. Mm. And all of that goes up into the air. And they can't close them off because of the gases that the coal gives off makes it, you know, too
dangerous.
Yeah.
20%. Yeah. So people who live like in Richmond, anywhere along this line, you know, they've reported that they're like, you know, just it covers your car, it goes in your lungs, it covers your cars. I mean, it would be much worse. It would be coming right through Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to keep an eye on. You can look at there's a group called No Coal in Oakland, and they have a really detailed about the case, about the different hearings.
Thank you. Yeah, that's great.
What you should know about Phil Tagami is that project, that coal project, is part of the Oakland Army Base redevelopment plan, and he was the man, his company was given that, they won that contract from the city of Oakland, because the city of Oakland owns that land. And so now he's turned, I mean, just think about it. I mean, he's a developer. I don't know if you guys know him. He did the Fox Theater in downtown Oakland, and he did the, you know, the Rotunda building in downtown Oakland. I mean, he was the president of the Port Commission. I mean, I cannot believe that he's doing this. He's doing this for short-term profit gain only, because this thing that he's doing will not last long. I mean, coal is going out. So it's almost like the man had a mental breakdown, because I know him, and he's just, it's just weird that he's doing this, you know?
By the way, he's a friend of Governor Brown.
Well,
Climate, and he's been completely mum on this. He's not going to...
Yeah, Jerry Brown hasn't said anything about it, but Jerry Brown put him on the Ports Commission. He was, and Jerry Brown was the guy who made him, you know, the Fox Theater, because they have the Oakland School for the Arts in the Fox Theater. Mm-hmm. That was one of Brown's pet projects when he was mayor. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a close tie. But Phil Tagami's an interesting guy, and I don't know why he's... The only thing I can see is that he's looking for a short-term profit off of this. Because otherwise, why would he be screwing Oakland when Oakland's been so good to him over the years? I don't know.
Well, a little bit of news on that. I mean, the big market for coal exports has been China, but increasingly less so, because China is actually moving aggressively on climate change itself, for instance, investing in solar panels. So it's going to be, I think, less of a market going forward.
Yeah. There's a huge power plant out in New Mexico, the Navajo plant. I don't know if you guys have ever gone toward the southwest. There's this giant coal-fired power plant out in the middle of nowhere, and it's fed by these giant coal mines, out there on Indian land. And they, I just saw an article in the paper this week that that is going to close.
Good.
Because they can't afford, even with the mine right next to the power plants, it's not cost effective anymore to run those coal-fired plants because of the gas prices. It's cheaper. They can get cheaper power from gas-fired plants. So that's closing. So that's another whole thing about this coal industry desperately trying to find a way to market their really bad environmental product.
Yeah, I can tell you that the sort of first attempt at subsidies for coal from the Trump administration basically failed. So that's good. They tried to get FERC to basically issue a ruling. FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, basically give money to coal and nuclear plants for some sort of a made-up reason, basically, but that's some reliability benefit that really doesn't exist. But FERC didn't go for it, basically. So they punted it. It's not going anywhere, basically. Tim.
Speaking of marketing, different types of energy, probably in the last 2 weeks we saw something on PBS about, I think it was in Morocco, where they have this huge government-subsidized project for solar, and the idea is that it's a contract that they have come into with European countries, and they're going to be building a grid to hopefully power a lot of Europe. Have you heard about that?
I haven't heard of that one, but it sounds interesting.
It's
their gamble that this is going to pay off. They're losing money on it now, but it's and it requires a lot of water too.
It doesn't sound like a PV technology then. Something else.
Well, if there's any last questions, because we want to wrap up by 2:15. So yeah.
Well, I would like to give a plug to an organization I've been working with, and we haven't talked about carbon pricing, but I've been working with the Citizen Climate Lobby, and among those things that's related to economics is there's actually going to have a forum on climate change and labor in San Francisco on March the 12th. So there's going to be unions represented talking about the ways that carbon pricing can actually encourage or actually boost employment and deal with the challenges of certain industries that would be certainly affected. So I have extra flyers here if people would like to take them with them.
Thank you.
This is on
Thank you.
Well.
Yes.
So we do have some resource information. Not at all comprehensive. Probably a lot of information in this room. People know a lot. But anyway, these are some of the things. Every city has some kind of climate action plan. So we gave the websites of all the cities and their climate action plans. The World Resources Institute, the Sierra Club, this Forest Stewardship Council that I told you about. So, and of course our book.
That we read, yeah.
And then the Quakers are having this talk on, you can tell us more.
March the 10th. The speaker is Cherise Bach, and is she's speaking about what's the title? Quakers and
Eco-Reformations.
Quakers and Eco-Reformation.
Part one. Stay tuned for part two. Thank you.
Mark the date for March.
So take the other thing. We have the resource page, and then we have this sort of a little bit of a summary of some of the things that are in the book. Bad news, good news thing on other sources of information besides the topics that we chose today. So take two of these, one of each. And
well, do you want to just pass them?
Thank you all for coming. It's been a pleasure. And I really had fun reading this book, and then because it's really readable, it's accessible for people, someone like me who is not schooled in all this information. So anyway, I found it to be a good resource, and it's just one thing. It's just one thing to do, to try and learn a bit more about what's going on in the world, and then try somehow to get involved. I want to go plant trees. Anyway, thank you all.
Thank you. Okay.